Okay, good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. It's been a while, so I hope everyone is still holding in the Rambam and where we left off. In the Makoros that I gave you, I realized that I didn't really put enough of Ibn Tibbon's letter for you to get an appreciation of what he was getting at. So I'm going to Blin Neder at the end of this year, put the whole letter in the chat, if anyone's interested in reading more on his perspective. But essentially, we left off with a contradiction in the Rambam. We talked about the potential, the suggestion of Ibn Tibbon to answer that question. We explained why we rejected that. But I think we still are left with an issue. And that, Be'ezus Hashem, is what we're going to be working on today, as well as, I hope, moving on to some other thinkers. I would like to move on to a different topic already for next week because we spent a while on this. Not that we have finished, nor will we finish, but I think it would be nice to start seeing some other sugyos as well. So let's just recall, I apologize for that, where we're holding. So we saw sort of two types of contradictions in the Rambam, potential contradictions, what we call the first and the second contradiction. And one of them didn't really bother us, but one we does bother us a bit more. The first contradiction is that the question, can evil, or can, sorry, not evil, can harm befall a righteous person? In 351, the Rambam said that misfortunes only occur to excellent people when they have hesach hadas from thinking about the Ribbono shel Olam. And the Rambam says at that point, providence withdraws. Yet in and that is consistent with what he says in 317 and 318. Ibn Tibbon was very troubled by the fact that in 323 he implies that even righteous people like Eov will experience misfortune, and that's why he saw that as a stira. And the resolution to the story of Eov, according to Rambam, was, well, if Eov would have had the right attitude, then the misfortune that he experienced wouldn't have troubled him so much. But the suggestion is that you could experience misfortune. And to that question, we said, well, so Ibn Tibbon saw that as a stira, and he sort of said, well, what he said in 351, he didn't really mean. We rejected that idea. We thought that you can't really say that about what the Rambam writes. And therefore, instead, what we said is that no, he's teaching you a different approach, which is that not everybody is like the Avos. Not everybody can, or succeeds at least, in thinking about a Kadosh Baruch Hu constantly. And as such, if you're not in that category, there will be times that you experience misfortune. And that being the case, so then the Rambam or the story of Eov teaches us how you should deal with those misfortunes. The second contradiction is the one that we sort of opened up at the beginning. This is, I think, a harder problem. And that is that the first thing we saw in the Rambam is that he absolutely upheld divine justice. And he said that nothing will befall a person unless they deserve it. He quoted the Gemara, or paraphrased the Gemara, about even the smallest things, right? Ad heichan yesurin, even the smallest things that a person experiences are deserved. Yet, in everywhere else, the Rambam seems to say that if you're not this tzaddik, this chassid who's constantly thinking about Hashem, then you're not going to be subject to constant hashgacha. And l'chora, if you're not subject to constant hashgacha, then memela, you will experience things that you don't really deserve. Because after all, l'chora, teva isn't so fair. If you're exposed to teva, so then you could have someone who's, you know, a righteous person get some type of freak disease or an accident or whatever it is, right? And those types of things aren't really deserved. So the only way it would seem to guarantee absolute justice is to say that there's constant constant hashgacha that will protect you from anything that you are unworthy of receiving. But that contradicts what the Rambam says, where he says not everybody is zocha to constant hashgacha. The only people that are these chassidim that are constantly thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But even tzaddikim who are normally thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but he said in 351, when they stop thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, providence withdraws, not totally, but somewhat. And therefore, aren't they subject at that point to teva? And doesn't that at least open up the possibility of their experiencing things that are undeserved? So I think that's more or less where we left off. That's the problem that we need to address. And we're going to propose two possible solutions, very different from each other. I don't know which is correct, but I have a slight netiyah. But that's what we need to do. Now, first, before we even get to the proposed solutions, let's consider some things which I don't think are a good solution. One solution is that, so this person who suffers because providence departed. So maybe we'll just say that, yes, his suffering is just. Why? Because the experiences that he has are a fair consequence for their failure to utilize this magnificent gift that's bestowed upon them by the Ribono Shel Olam. In other words, they had the possibility of being in category one, the category of people, the Hasidim, from whom Hashkacha never departs. Like the Rambam says in the Chos Tshuva, everybody could be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. So if they were a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu, so Moshe Rabbeinu never had Hashkacha depart from him. He could have been a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, if they were a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu, then he would have been spared. So there's nothing unjust about what they received. Because they didn't, it's a fair consequence. You know, it's sort of like, I was speaking to someone about this, a friend of mine, he compared this to benign neglect. You know, they Hashem neglects them as a consequence for their failure to live up to their potential. The problem with this solution, I think, is that some people experience tortuous pain and l'chora, their failure to take advantage of God's invitation doesn't seem to account for their searing agony. Moreover, is it really true that everyone has the capability of connecting to the Ribono Shel Olam at this highest level? This is a general issue in the Rambam. If you look at 318 especially, you will see that the Rambam emphasizes the intellectual connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is something that the Rambam himself writes, that not everybody is granted the same intellectual or cerebral capabilities. You know, we're not born equally. The Rambam writes in the Chos Tshuva, everybody could be a tzaddik like Moshe, but the Rambam writes explicitly in Mor Nevuchim, and this is probably obvious as well, that not everybody could be a chacham like Moshe. There are limitations that some of us have. Now, you can try to sort of downplay the Rambam's focus on the intellect and sort of play up his focus on mitzvos. which I think is a plausible read. But I think that's an issue with this solution. So another possible solution, which again, I don't think is going to be correct, is to suggest that HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes to prevent unjust suffering. Meaning to say, no, if you're not in that category one, the Hasidim who are constantly thinking about the Ribono Shel Olam, so then you are sometimes subject to Teva. But if you're being subject to Teva would lead to an injustice, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu would step in and prevent that from happening. And that seems to be okay. I mean, the Rambam, as we saw, definitely upholds the possibility of nisim and involvement. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu would make sure that it doesn't happen. Yes. In other words, when they're being subject, they are sometimes subject to Teva, but Hashem will ensure that they don't suffer unjustly. I think that could be a possible solution. The issue here is the following. Is this really consistent with the tone of Rambam's treatment of Hashgacha? I think that when you read it, at least it sounds to me like he rejects the idea of Hashem constantly intervening with almost everybody, because that's what would have to happen for this model to work. That's what would have to happen. Meaning to say, if Hashem is going to ensure that nobody ever suffers unjustly, so then even for all those people, you know, for everybody who is not in that category one, the people who are constantly connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu would always have to be stepping in to make sure that they don't suffer unjustly through Teva. And we saw that the tone of the Rambam, I think, does make me at least hesitant about that, because as we saw, the Rambam does seem to sort of play up this naturalistic idea. You know, again, he allows for the possibility of intervention, but he's trying to limit that. Another suggestion is to just deny injustice. Yeah, it seems like righteous people are suffering or innocent people are suffering, but maybe whatever pain they're experiencing has a purpose and therefore is in some way just. I don't think this is correct. If you recall back to how the Rambam criticizes the Mutazila who offer this suggestion, so I think that doesn't really work. So what can we say? So as I said, we're going to present two approaches. And the first is going to, I would say, argue for a more limited perspective in the Rambam towards Hashgacha. And the second, which is more my Natiya, is a little bit more expansive. I told you at the beginning that my approach to this has changed a little bit. So the last time we were learning this sugya, I liked the first approach, but now my inclination is more for the second approach. But Be'ezras Hashem, B'siyata D'shmaya, in discussing it and considering it, will be zocha to understand the emes. So the first approach, maybe there are times that the innocent suffer due to their exposure to Teva. How could this be? The Rambam says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu never allows people to suffer unjustly. The answer is that what the Rambam rejected was the possibility that God would cause a person to suffer unjustly. And he even says that he would never even cause a person to suffer unjustly in order to reward them in the world to come. That's why he rejected the idea of Yisurin Shalava. However, in this case where they suffer unjustly due to their exposure to Teva, it is not the case that God is causing them to suffer. As indicated, as we saw by the Rambam in 3:12, which we mentioned last time, the Rambam talks about the different sources of evil in the world. And their suffering is a natural consequence of us being physical and they're being part of this world that exists. And if we look at the Lashon in 3:17, I think we could find support for this possibility. Take a look back at 3:17. The Rambam, when he is telling us, you know, upholding the principle of divine justice, this is what he writes. Lo ya'anosh echad mimenu, ela, I copied it wrong. Vashem chalila lo me'avel, v'anachnu namin shekol elo enyanim ha'anoshim hem kefi hadin ha'mechuyev v'haraui la'onesh. So he's saying that, you know, we believe that all these human affairs are managed with justice. Far be it from God to do wrong, punish anyone, unless the punishment is necessary and merited. So what I think you could say, it sounds like, is Hashem, what the Rambam is saying is that Hashem would never punish someone unjustly. That's true. And again, in advocating for this, he is sort of rejecting even, you know, views of those Muslim scholars and even some in Chazal. So God will never punish a person unless they're deserving. Doesn't mean they'll never suffer. And how would we justify this? We would simply say something that the Rambam himself says, which is that God, in his infinite and incomprehensible wisdom, decided to create a world that is sometimes, or maybe even largely, left to nature. We can't understand the reason for his decision. The Rambam writes in a number of places that to ask why Hashem created the world this way and not that way, wouldn't it have been better if he made the world in a different manner? That is not an intelligent question. The Rambam thinks that once you believe in Bria, and we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu certainly made the best possible world. But from within the world, we can't really say, well, maybe you should have done it differently. It would have been better if it was this way and not that way. No, that's not a smart question. That's what the Rambam writes. And in fact, this is exactly the lesson that we saw. The Rambam tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Iov in the Tempest, don't expect to understand everything. Were you around when I created the world? Were you around? If you were around, if you watched me create the world, so then you could say, okay, you know, yeah, maybe you should have done it this way, not that way, but you weren't. So it doesn't make sense to even ask the question. And because the best possible world is a world which involves the laws of nature, so then it necessarily follows that some people will suffer without a cause. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, within the laws of nature, allows a person to transcend nature's dominion over them, however. And he does that by connecting to God. And to the extent that you succeed in connecting to God, so then you'll no longer be subject to the whims of happenstance. Most religious people, the Rambam says in 351, do this while they're doing mitzvos and learning Torah and the like. Extraordinarily righteous people succeed in doing this always, even when they're engaged in the mundane. People that rise to such a level will never suffer with, you know, pain without just causes. Others have to learn the lesson of Iov and appreciate that though these travails might hurt, A, if they have the right values, they're not going to hurt as much. And B, they have the ability to rise above them, to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's always an option. So that is the first approach. It's a difficult approach. You could say, well, you know, that's still not just. It's unfair that someone would suffer undeservedly just because they fail to connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam at the highest level. Maybe the Rambam would respond. They should remember this other lesson that we learn from Iov, which is we can't expect to understand God's ways. So that's one approach. But again, I think we could still be troubled by the justice of this approach. But that's one approach. Another drawback of this approach is the statements of the Rambam that we opened up with. And this brings us way back. But like what we saw in Hilchos Taniyos and Hilchos Avel and his letter to the Jews of Marseille, where the Rambam warned us not to attribute misfortune to Mikra, right? And if you do, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yasachte Aleichem Od Chamas Keri, right? If we attribute our misfortunes to Mikra, so then we will experience more suffering. And not only that, the Rambam says that if you do attribute your suffering to Mikra, that's Achzarius. Well, once we allow for the possibility of Mikra to be the cause of suffering, then what's so bad about attributing it to Mikra? So again, you could say, well, the Rambam's principal objection was, you know, failure to do tshuva. And even if you do suffer as a result of Mikra, but the response still has to be tshuva. Yisurin ban liyadcha yifashish m'maisav. It's true whether or not the source of that suffering is Mikra. But at the same time, I think we could question how, you know, this approach addresses those sources. So, maybe we should have, even added that to the stirath, right? We were, when we raised the stirs in the Rambam, we were sort of focusing on the stirs within Mar Nevuchim. We forgot to go back to the stirs from Mishneh Torah and his other writings. And I think that's something. So that's I think that's the difficulty with this first approach. So what other approach could we say? So I think the other approach we could consider is comes from going back to 351 and looking at it again carefully. So let's remember what the Rambam says in 351. The Rambam basically said that there are three categories of people. Number one, the people who never connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and they experience no hashgacha whatsoever. If you remember, the Rambam in 318 compared such people to animals who are unworthy of providence. Group number two, which I assume is most people, certainly most Jews, hopefully, is people who occasionally connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam while meditating, while doing mitzvos, while studying Torah. Such individuals always experience some level of hashgacha due to their latent connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. However, they only experience total hashgacha when connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That was group two. And group three was those extraordinary people who are so close to God that their intellect is always occupied with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and this bond guarantees that they are protected even when they're occupied in material things. So now let's go back to our shaila about justice. Obviously, there's no shaila about justice with the third group. The question is, what about the first two? So what about the middle group? So regarding the middle group, Rambam writes that such people are not like the first group because of their latent attachment to the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is actualized when they do mitzvos or learn Torah or the like, but it's always there in potential. That's what the Rambam writes. So the Rambam is basically saying, I think, that they're always subject to partial hashgacha. So the question we need to ask is, what does partial hashgacha mean? In other words, partial hashgacha at first glance is a very hard concept to understand, because mima nafshach, can you be harmed without, due to tava, without deserving it or not? If yes, so then you're in the first category. And if no, so then in what sense is there partial hashgacha? So you could say partial hashgacha means like, yesh v'yesh, on and off, right? Sometimes you're subject to hashgacha, sometimes not. Maybe for big things you're subject to hashgacha, for small things you're not. Maybe that's what he would say. You know, I think that's probably what I was assuming in the first Mahalich. But maybe it means something else. Maybe it means that Parshal Hashgacha means HaKadosh Baruch Hu watches over them and ensures that they do not suffer unjustly by nature, such that if they do suffer, it is deserved. And as such, justice is preserved, right? So let's look at some of his Lashonos. In 318, he writes, as for the ignorant and disobedient, their state is despicable proportionally to their lack of this overflow. That's the first category. So this suggests that it's only the wicked, the category one, who lack hashgacha. But the individual who is observant, so he's not, right? Likewise, a bit later in that same chapter, he writes, those who are far from him are given over to whatever may happen to befall them. Again, category one. For they are, for there is nothing to protect them against whatever may occur. Right, I think over there he's explaining the pasuk in Tehillim, which states that the wicked shall be put to silence and darkness and the like. And the mashmos is that it's only the wicked who are left to teva. So what would emerge then, perhaps, is it's only the third group who never connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam that are left to the whims of nature, who may suffer randomly. The Rambam might think that this doesn't violate justice insofar as their abandonment is an appropriate punishment for their total abandonment of God. They have totally abandoned God. It's not just that they failed to live up to this, you know, extraordinary milah, the meat of the avos, the people who are constantly connected to God. No, every person can connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Perhaps the Rambam even thinks every person naturally will connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And certainly we who are given the Torah and commanded to do mitzvos, and we fail, if someone fails to do that entirely, so they have only themselves to blame. And therefore the Rambam sees no injustice in the fact that this first group of people who the Rambam has categorized as wicked and are people who have no mitzvos, no Torah, no tefillah, no connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that they are left to nature. The Rambam thinks that isn't unjust because Hashem made them such that they naturally connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and therefore they are left to teva if they fail to live up to that. A topic that's an interesting topic, but not certainly for today, is, you know, is there such a thing for the Rambam as someone who sort of innocently fails to connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam? I mean, it's, you know, they don't believe in God, let's say, but it's not really their fault. Nobody taught them, or they just, you know, they're not convinced, or whatever it is. That's a very important topic. Sometimes Reb Chaim's famous statement of Nebuchadnezzar is Achatanabikaris. And maybe we could get back to that point. I think that that's not the Pashup shot in the Rambam. I'm not sure that Reb Chaim, how he meant that, right? The Rambam has this concept of Tinok Shenishba, who is someone who's an Abikaris, fails to believe in the Ikari Emunah, but yet at the same time is not treated like an Abikaris, because it's not his fault, but that's for another conversation. So that's the third category of people, right? Now, I should point out, and this is obvious, that the people in the third category, these wicked people, might enjoy success and prosperity. Nature might look kindly upon them. But should they suffer, it's also not because of an intentional punishment for their wrongdoing. Their free will might have caused them to be in the wrong place and in the wrong time, you know, whatever it is. That's category three. The second category, the middle category of people, like we said, most people So they enjoy hashgacha. What's the nature of hashgacha? How does their hashgacha differ than the first category, the chassidim? What does the Rambam mean that he says that when people in these middle category of people, providence withdraws when they stop actively thinking about the Ribbono Shel Olam, even though they're that have in potential? So the Rambam's Lashon 351 is like this. Ki kol mi shehechen atzmo ad sheshafa alav haseichel hahu tidabek bo hashgacha v'yimne'u mimenu haraos kula. So when he's talking about the first category of people, what are they guaranteed, right? What are they guaranteed? So Rambam writes, v'yimne'u mimenu haraos kula. They are guarded from all evils. In other words, someone who's constantly connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam is zoicha to a certain shmira. The shmira, right, is basically constant protection. What the Rambam here says is very reminiscent of the famous school in Nefesh HaChayim, that if a person, you know, while they have absolutely internalized and feel ein od milvado, then they can't be harmed. That seems to be what the Rambam is saying, right? The yimnu menu haros kulam. Ad kedei kach, that the Rambam says, you know, if they experience some type of misfortune, must be that that happened at a moment when they were mesiach das. So that is the first group. The second group, however, is only assured that protection, that shmira, when they're actively connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam. When that connection breaks, so God allows nature to harm them if they're deserving of harm. In other words, what's the Rambam, what's our resolution? Our resolution is that the group one, these chassidim that are not mesiach das, have constant shmira. That constant shmira is not held by the second group of people. Second group of people don't have constant shmira, right? So they could be harmed by nature. God allows them to be harmed by nature when they're mesiach das. But God only allows them to be harmed by nature if they deserve to be harmed. If they don't deserve to be harmed, they won't be harmed. So now there's no kasha from justice because nobody is suffering unjustly. The group, first group isn't suffering unjustly because they're zocha to constant shmira. The second group isn't suffering unjustly because Hashem will only, they have providence, they just don't have shmira. So Hashem will only allow them to suffer by nature if in fact they're mesiach das. And then they will suffer by nature. And nature does cause lots of suffering, but only if it's their deserved. If they deserve it, Hashem allows them to be suffer through nature. And finally, in terms of the third group, so we said the Rambam doesn't see that as a stira to justice because they fail to connect to Ribbono Shel Olam and live up to that natural connection that they should have had. They fail to do Torah mitzvot entirely. So the fact that they're left to teva is deserved, according to the Rambam. Does this limit? So again, it is limited providence in a sense because teva exists. Teva exists, and it only doesn't affect that first group of people. But at the same time, I think we can uphold what the Rambam says, which is that there is absolute justice, no steer to justice. This would also, I think, allow us to easily explain the statements in Hilchos Tanios and the like, because it's absolutely correct. When a person experiences misfortune, they can't just attribute it to teva and say, well, this happened because of teva. It might be true that it happened through teva. Yes, it happened through teva. But why was it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed you to suffer through teva? Because you deserve to suffer. So the proper response has to be tshuva, because the suffering you got was something that was appropriate, something that you deserve. It also, I think, helps us explain how the Rambam, you know, said each and every day, al nisecha v'al neflosecha shebechol yom erva voker v'tzarayim, right? We are wondering, how could the Rambam say that? You know, I think if you take the first approach we suggested today, I don't know if it's a direct stira, but it's not pashut. It's not pashut. Nisecha shemachol yom erev v'boker v'tzarayim. Right? Maybe I'm in the middle camp, so I don't have nisim v'chol yom erev v'boker v'tzarayim. Well, if we take this approach, I think we could say it's very meduyuk. Because anyone saying modim is obviously at least in the second camp, right? They're at least occasionally connecting to Kodesh Baruch Hu, at least while they're davening, they're connecting to him. Hopefully they're paying attention to the words that they're saying, right? So anyone in that category will, in a sense, experience nisim shebechol yom erev v'boker v'tzarayim. They might not, they're obviously not nisim guyim, but a Kodesh Baruch Hu does give them hashkacha, and the hashkacha is will ensure that they never suffer unjustly. They don't have constant shmira like the first category, but it doesn't say al hashmira shebechol ezer v'boker v'tzarayim. But yes, there is hashkacha. So that is the second mahalich. Those are the two mahalchim that I was thinking. I'll take any questions or comments, but first just make one last point. Is there a nafkamina in all this? Whether you take the first approach of the Rambam or the second approach of the Rambam. Let's say you don't even like my second approach. You think the first approach is right. You think that the Rambam has a more limited, even more limited approach to hashkacha. Is there a nafkamina? Right? A lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about the sugya of hashkacha, and they're sort of bothered by the idea in some Rishonim, including the Rambam, that there is such a thing as teva. And one question I think you have to ask ourselves is l'may nafkamina. So I once asked this question to Rav Tversky, and he told me that he thinks there is no nafkamina in this debate. Because like we said before, everybody agrees. The Gemara in Bracho says, Yisurin ban liyatcha yefashvesh b'maisav. And our response to suffering, tragedy, and the like has to be tshuva. And that's true whether you take an all-expansive approach to hashkacha, that everything is subject to hashkacha, or you think, no, that only some things are subject to hashkacha and some things are subject to teva. It's still true. It's still true. So even if you're going to go ahead and take a more limited approach to hashkacha, and you're going to acknowledge that it's a possibility that today when I fell and I scraped my knees, and I don't know, I got an infection, that was a result of teva. And it's random. Let's even say that's right. But I still, regardless, my approach has to be Yisurin ban liyatcha yefashvesh b'maisav. There's no nafkamina, right? So what? So it's a suffix whether this was a divine act or not. But still, my response is to be tshuva. Moreover, certainly in the Rambam, again, according to any approach you're going to take, it will be the case that you experience this mishap only because you failed to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at least at the moment that it happened, which is something that we always could work on doing better. And as such, it's certainly true, according to the Rambam, that, had they not been Mesiach Das, they wouldn't have experienced, they wouldn't have scraped their knee and gotten that infection or whatever. So therefore, Halacha lemaisa, I think that there isn't really a nafkamina. I'll make one other point before moving on from the Rambam, which is that there are other approaches to the Rambam. There are many great thinkers, Talmidei Chachamim, Tzadikim, scholars of the Rambam, people who know Rambam really well, and believe that even the Rambam advocates for the type of all-encompassing hashkacha that other great Jewish thinkers have advocated for, despite the mashmos of, I think, other statements of the Rambam, like chapters 317 and 318. Again, I don't really understand how they read the Rambam, because the Rambam does seem to say that there's such a thing as teva, and people that are Mesiach Das from HaKadosh Baruch Hu left to teva. But it is important for you to know that such great thinkers do exist. And again, each of us has to do our best in terms of understanding the Rambam. An interesting thing to think about is the following, that there's no question that if you look at many of the contemporary thinkers on the topic of Hashgacha, the overwhelming approach is to reject this concept of Teva existing, Kimat. Meaning to say, the belief that everything that happens to a person is Hashgacha. We saw that, for example, in the Chazon Ish that we saw a number of weeks ago. Though we saw that even within the Chazon Ish, it's somewhat ambiguous, though that is what he said in Emunah Bitachon. We saw his comments in Bava Basra somewhat seem to contradict that. Be that as it may, you look at Sfarim like Mechtav Me'Eliyahu, certainly the Chassidish Sfarim, which we'll talk about in a moment, and many others. The impression that you get is certainly that many thinkers, you know, what has become the dominant view is more towards absolute Hashgacha. Despite the fact that at least in many Rishonim, the Rambam and even the Ramban's view, which I would have liked to work on with you, but I don't think we're going to have a chance, is somewhat ambiguous. As we noted, there are steers in the Ramban Shita, and trying to understand the Ramban Shita. But nevertheless, I think that there certainly has been the shift. And the question is, you know, how do you deal with it? Because after all, you know, obviously, usually when we learn, we focus on the Rishonim. It's very unlikely that you'll have a sugya and haracha where, you know, most of Rishonim are taking one approach and most of the Achronim are taking a different approach. You do sometimes, though, have that in the realm of machshava. And I think there's a lot that accounts for that shift, including Hashgacha. I don't think, maybe another time, we could talk a little bit about why and how that happens. I think part of it might relate to the fact that the Rambam's view, for example, is rooted in his sort of quasi-Aristotelian conception of the universe and his Havana of physics and metaphysics. Now, certainly we don't believe that the Rambam, you know, bought into Aristotle wholesale, as we've seen. Even in this very topic, the Rambam writes explicitly, I'm rejecting Aristotle's opinion. But perhaps one might say that as we've sort of shed that conception of the universe entirely, we don't share, you know, we don't buy into Aristotle's science and physics and metaphysics. So then those reasons to limit Hashgacha are no longer valid in our eyes. Why should it be that there isn't constant Hashgacha? After all, Hayad Hashem Titzar. So everything is subject to Hashgacha Asma. Like, what's holding back? Why wouldn't that be the case? Mechatesi, not that way. That's one reason. Another reason does relate, perhaps, to the spreading of Kabbalah and the Giluyim of Kabbalah, and especially the Kabbalah of the Arizal. We can't just say it's Kabbalah, because like I said, the Ramban also does seem to allow for some existence of Teva, even though the Ramban was certainly a Mekubal. Again, you know, it's easy to say, well, the Ramban didn't have the Kabbalah, so that's why the Ramban believed in Teva. But anyone who had the Kabbalah wouldn't, because how do you explain the Rambans? Now, either way, the Rambans are a problem, because as we know, on the one hand, he says anyone that believes in Teva has no chelik in Teres Moshe. He says that on multiple occasions. And yet on other occasions, he seems to allow for the existence of Teva. If we had time, we would work on the Ramban. But I do think it is possible that the spreading of Kabbalah is a factor here. And finally, you know, I think that even though we do believe that Rishonim can learn in, but there is this possibility of more of a Birur HaEmes as time goes on. And that as we learn and learn and learn more, we do come to a better Havana of certain things. And it's not just that it's a downward slope from, you know, the Tanaim to the Amoraim to the Gaonim to the Rishonim to the Achronim to us. No, there is a concept of progress. And, you know, it's true. Reb Chaim said Rishonim can learn in, but Reb Chaim also was Mechadesh, a tremendous Mahalich. And even though we believe that the Mahalich wasn't a Chiddush Yesh Me'ayin, and it's rooted in the Torah, the Rishonim, but nevertheless, there is something new there. There is progress. You know, the Balei HaTosfos progressed, you know, in their Derech HaLimud, and through that brought out more Torah. And then the Chachmei Sfarad after them progressed from the Balei HaTosfos, and through that brought out more Limud. That's still true. And that does allow for a certain level of development as long as it's rooted in the Masorah. And I think the progress in this case could certainly be attributed to being rooted in the Masorah. If you want to say that idea in a more mystical way, which I think is also correct, the way we would put it, and this is the way a number of thinkers do put it, is as we get closer to the Mashiach, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu does reveal certain things to us that until now have remained hidden or were originally hidden. If you look at a number of thinkers who say this, they sometimes say it, you could say it in a positive and in a negative way, and they could both be true simultaneously. I saw that the Lubavitcher Rebbe said this idea. I saw a similar idea in the writings of Rebbe Leo Weintraub, who was a Litvish in the Kubel. And that is that, you know, this is both a reflection of our higher state as we get closer to Mashiach, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu is megala new things, and also sort of a low state, that because humanity is in such a sort of a bad place in terms of being so far from the Ribono Shel Olam, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs to sort of give us a little bit to keep us with him. However you understand it, I think all these things can account for this shift. And so I don't think it's something that we have to deny, or even that's something that has to scare us. Because as long as the shift is rooted in the Masorah, I think it's certainly true. And those who do advocate for this broader Hashkacha do have ample sources in Chazal, in Tanakh, in Chazal, and even in Rishonim and Achronim, even in the Tekufa Rishonim. It's not like all the Rishonim believed in such a concept of Teva. There are many Rishonim that do advocate for an all-encompassing approach to Hashkacha, or a nearly all-encompassing approach, let's say Rabbeinu Bachya and Chovas Alvavos. So I think it's very, very important for us to understand that as well. So with that in mind, I was hoping, first of all, let me take any questions. Okay, good. So I'd like to now, I'd like to move on. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Would Rambam believe that it's like almost part of it's a heretical to believe into, like, in terms of the Kabbalistic view of like total hashkacha and not really having the teva? Or
I don't think it's at all heretical. It's not against the Ikar Emuna. The Rambam, you know, it's very important. I think you bring up a great point. Thank you. Which is that there's a big difference between either way, between an error and something that's heretical. There's all sorts of mistakes that a person might make, but doesn't mean that they're a heretic. So I don't see anywhere in the Rambam where the Rambam implies that believing in absolute hashkacha is heretical. No, you know, again, if he thought, if he started denying divine justice or something like that. And again, I think I would even add, and this is very important, the Rambam acknowledged that even, you know, in Chazal, there were debates about this question, like his point about the opinion that says there is such a thing as Misa B'lo Chet, or the opinions in Chazal that say they're Yisur and Shalava. The Rambam thinks we don't accept those views, but he acknowledges that they're out there. He's not causing the advocates of those perspectives heretics. So no, I don't see anything in the Rambam that would suggest that he believed that's heresy. It may be a mistake, but not heresy.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so again, we're pretty short on time left, but I want to turn to maybe the other extreme. So again, based off of what we're saying, not so much the opposite extreme, but the other extreme, and that is the view that's found in Chassidus, which you have on your Makaros back from the first shir on Hashgacha. And we're going to go to the Baal Shem Tov. Now, first of all, I want to warn against comparing the Rambam to Baal Shem Tov in this sort of way. It's something that I've heard Rav Aaron Lapiansky, whenever he's asked this question, this is always a point that he makes, which is that in a sense, what we're comparing apples and oranges. What do I mean? So let's learn a little bit about the Baal Shem Tov. Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, he was born in 1698. He lived until 1760. He was known as the Baal Shem Tov because he was known for his mofsim and his Kabbalah and the like. And he, of course, is seen as the father of Chassidus, which was really a revolution. And it's certainly the case that one aspect of the Baal Shem Tov's theology, which has become widely accepted, is his perspective on Hashgacha. You could argue that even if he didn't make everybody Chassidim, he certainly pushed the pendulum a little farther in terms of the approach to, our acceptance of a sweeping and maybe, he advocates an all-encompassing Hashgacha. But we have to remember when we're studying the works of the Baal Shem Tov that...
Which sheet is this on? Sorry to interrupt.
So the first, I sent you that long thing on Hashgacha. And so first it had Makaros in the Rambam, then in the Ramban, then... did I not send this? Okay. We'll talk about it next time. So I'll give it to you next time, and then this time we'll just talk about it outside. I guess we won't read anything inside. And now that you pointed that out, I remember that maybe I didn't send it out. So Bezras Hashem for next time. So going back to the Baal Shem Tov, the Baal Shem Tov did not write a sefer on philosophy like the Rambam did. We have almost nothing from the direct hand of the Baal Shem Tov, a couple of letters. Fascinating letters, they talk about Aliyas HaNeshama and the like, but we don't have anything he wrote. We have lots and lots of stories. We have like Shivchei Abesht, which even those are a bit later, but we have lots of stories. We have lots of teachings. His Talmidim frequently will relate a teaching on, this is how the Baal Shem Tov read a certain pasuk and the like. You'll see that all the time if you study Chassidus. Let's say you take a more classical work that a lot of people have learned, like Tanya. He's often quoting like a vart in a pasuk. This is how the Baal Shem Tov understood this pasuk. But I don't think that we find a systematic perspective on machshava or on philosophy. A lot of it, comparing the Baal Shem Tov to the Rambam straight is like, to some degree, comparing math and literature. Their works, their styles, their goals were utterly different. And so, But if you compare them straight, I think it does sort of misrepresent their viewpoints. You know, the Torah we have in the Baal Shem Tov is the Torah he taught his Talmidim, but we don't have any type of systematic teaching. But at the same time, you know, the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov and the stories of the Baal Shem Tov that have been passed down to us do reflect a approach to Hashgacha, and one that, like we said, has had a huge influence. And therefore, I think it is something that we can look at and compare it to what was before and the implications. And there's no question that the Baal Shem Tov did advocate for an all-encompassing approach to Hashgacha. There's a very famous story about the Baal Shem Tov in which he tells his Talmidim that Hashgacha extends to absolutely everything, even the manner in which a branch falls from a tree. Again, it's not Yishmiayim. In that story, he goes ahead and he quotes a pasuk. It's a pasuk in Kohelas, Parakid Aleph, pasuk Gimel. The pasuk says, "Makom sheyipol ha'etz sham yehu," which means wherever the tree will fall, or wherever the stick will fall, that's where it's supposed to be. And you could certainly understand that as saying, yeah, if the tree, if the branch, even if the leaf falls this way and not that way, that's Hashgacha. That's the way Hashem was goes there. We already saw the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Zayin Amud Beis, says that Ein Adam Nokef Etzba'o Elin Kein Machrizin Alav Milamala. So that could be understood as a saying, not just Nokef Etzba'o, but even the smallest thing is also a result. And I guess we'll pick up with this next time, but it's not just that, you know, we do have some mikoros that suggest this, but it's the point that I was saying before, which is, why shouldn't it be that way? I guess you could think about this for next week on Beis Hashem. We'll pick up with this next week. I think next week will be our last year on Hashgacha, which is, you know, can anyone think of a reason why would it be that everything isn't subject to Hashgacha? Like, why would, okay, let's take the falling of a leaf. You know, if I was running a system, so yeah, I would, how leaves fall, I'd say, who cares? L'may nafkamina. So let the leaf fall the way it falls. Let that be left to nature. What do I need to be involved in that? But that's only because I'm limited in my capacity, right? I lack the ability to think about absolutely everything at all times, at all moments, and absolutely control everything, right? I'm limited. I'm human. So of course, when you're human, you delegate, right? And you go ahead and you think, okay, you know, I'm going to focus on the important things because I'm limited. I'm going to leave, you know, other things to every, you know, to other people. You know, I'll leave it off to nature. Fine. But obviously the cheshbon doesn't make sense. So why not? Why wouldn't it be? So I think that's a very important thing to bring up. And that's going to be an important point that they make. And so Be'ezras Hashem, next week we will worry about correctly understanding the Mahalach of the Baal Shem Tov. In the meantime, everybody should have a good Shabbos. I see there's questions, so I will be happy to take them now and cultivate. Yes, Jake.
Is Rebbe suggesting at the end of Shir that, I mean, I'm just asking if the Mahalach is going to be along the lines that what about Bechira Chavshis, meaning if every single thing is Hashgacha?
That's a great question. In other words, if you are, and not just a question about Zem Tov, the truth is that's a question on everybody, which is, you know, how does Bechira relate to Hashgacha? Everybody's going to have that issue because, you know, even if, you know, what do we say about that question? If we believe that there is Bechira Chavshis, doesn't that mean that Reuven could harm Shimon? It's in Reuven's power to harm Shimon and the like. I believe that every Jewish thinker, every serious Jewish thinker that we take seriously, you know, believes in Bechira Chavshis. So that being the case, to some degree at least, So that being the case, and that includes the Chassidish thinkers, and even the Chassidish thinkers that might sound in certain places that they don't, I don't think that's a correct understanding. So that being the case, we have to figure out how does that fit with the sort of all-encompassing Hashkacha. One possibility is to say it's an exception, right? Meaning to say, you're right. When these thinkers advocate for absolute Hashkacha, they're saying with the exception of Bechira Chafshis, right? And you have a place for that. I mean, it says in Chazal, you know, Kol B'dei Shemayim Chotzi Rishamayim. So what does that mean? Kol B'dei Shemayim, everything is B'yad Hashem, everything is subject to Hashkacha. Chotz, Mir Shemayim. What's your Shemayim? Bechira Chafshis, right? They also say Kol B'dei Shemayim Chotzi Mitzinu Mepachem. Let's figure out what that means. Maybe Tzinu Mepachem is very small, it's very limited. Maybe that's just, you know, punishment for your own negligence. It's a good question. But either way, yes. So that's a big shaila that we have to ask. How does this work with Bechir Chafshis? Can it be that people suffer unjustly or no? You know, the simplest answer, so some thinkers do advocate for that. Famous Archaim HaKadosh that you're probably familiar with, which is really a Zohar, at least it's the Pashup Shem Zohar. That's one ha'ara that needs to be dealt with. The simplest solution is no, that yes, my freedom, my Bechira Chafshis allows me to try to do whatever I want, but it doesn't mean I'll succeed. Meaning to say, somebody, you know, Ruvain might get up in the morning and say, I'm going to kill Shimon. That's his Bechira. And he gets up and he buys a gun and he loads the gun and he shoots. But maybe the gun will jam. Maybe he'll miss. Maybe he'll get the cop will pull him over on the way to his attempt, right? So we could just say that Bechira Chafshis, nobody thinks, means that you're going to succeed in everything that you're going to try. So of course he's going to try to kill Shimon. Yeah. But Kodesh Baruch Hu, if Shimon isn't supposed to die, Kodesh Baruch Hu will make sure that Shimon doesn't die. So Kodesh Baruch Hu somehow orchestrates matters that a person still has Bechira, but yet we can ensure that nobody will suffer undeservedly. And likewise, we could say the reverse. What if Shimon is supposed to die, yet Reuven decides not to kill him because he has Bechira? So Kadosh Baruch Hu can make sure that Shimon dies in a different way. So he'll be struck by lightning or whatever it is, right? So so I don't know if that's going to really be a problem, but certainly something to think about. Yes, Israel.
How would even from the scope of Teva, I mean, with just determinism and the idea of like, if we're going to acknowledge the idea of Teva and then I guess it seems more of like a modern discussion of, in terms of like how people make decisions and how like that's based a lot on biology and on situational things and whatnot.
That is a great, great question. And we could do that after we're done Hashkacha. Be'etzim, I think that's a separate shaila. That's really a shaila of Bechira Chafshis, right? If you believe that, you know, what is the true source of my decisions? Is it just my nature and my nurture? Is it my genes and my environment or the like? You know, which is basically what advocates of a deterministic approach to the universe are saying. They're saying, look, you know, the source of even my own decisions is just the way things started off as. And while I might feel free, that's just my brain tricking myself, and I'm not actually free. I think I'm able to freely choose, but really everything is coming from, you know, everything that preceded me, and take a, you know, a deterministic approach to the universe, at least with the exception of maybe on the quantum scale, which does seem to be indeterministic. So
wouldn't that challenge the Rambam though, in the sense that meaning now, yes, it almost defers the idea of like no Bechira, just a Teva instead of...
Rambam absolutely rejects that. It's true. And if you look at, and I think it would be great to have a shiur on that. Maybe, as I said, maybe we could do it next because it is very related. If you look at the Rambam in Perkei of Hilchos Tshuva, he actually rejects four types of determinism.
Which source is
Hilchos Tshuva Perkei. He considers and rejects four types of determinism. In other words, there are all sorts of reasons why you can deny Bechira. And this is one of them. We put it in sort of modern terminology, but this isn't a new idea.
Okay.
So the Rambam is definitely addressing that. And again, I think that all Jewish sources reject that sort of determinism. And it's a good question, you know, how and where that's coming from.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. My pleasure. Good Shabbos. Good Shabbos.
That's one question.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Just if you could just summarize again, like, what's the exact point of departure, the two different approaches you're had of the Rambam in the, in the beginning of this year?
Yeah, sure. So the first approach of the Rambam says that if you're not zocha to this all-encompassing hashgacha, because you're not the type of person that's always thinking about the Ribbono Shel Olam, so then indeed you will be left to teva. But doesn't the Rambam say that Hashem doesn't punish people that aren't deserving? The answer is yes, that's absolutely true. Hashem doesn't punish people that aren't deserving. So if you suffer, it's not Hashem punishing you. It's because you were left to Teva. That's the first approach. So the first approach, according to the first approach, it is the case that unless you're in that first class of people who are constantly thinking about the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know, and you suffer. Maybe that was random. Maybe that was haphazard.
That's not unjust. It's not unjust for, so to speak, for Hashem to leave you to nature because of your Hesed Hadas, because you're not in that first class.
I would say the following: It's not unjust because HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a world which has Teva. And that is because for whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu's agenda is in the world, that's important to exist. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a person the ability to rise above Teva by connecting to Ribbono Shel Olam. But at the same time, there is such a thing as Teva, and such that when a person doesn't reach that Madrega, so they're left to Teva. And that's the way Hashem made it. Everything Hashem does directly is absolutely just. Hashem rewards a person for their mitzvos, he punishes them for their averos, 100% justice. But it doesn't mean that a person won't sometimes suffer as a consequence of their physicality, as a consequence of their being in this material world and therefore subject to Teva, which is something HaKadosh Baruch Hu created. It's not like we're saying Teva is in, you know, independent force, Rahman al-Itzlan. Kadosh Baruch Hu created everything, Yesh Me'ayin, including Teva. Kadosh Baruch Hu created the laws of Teva. But the laws of Teva are such that, yeah, when when I drop a ball, it falls. And when a person is subject to Teva, so Memela, those things will happen. Rambam isn't saying that a person will never suffer unjustly. The Rambam is simply saying that a Kadosh Baruch Hu will never punish a person unjustly. But as a consequence of their being part of Teva, then they suffer. They might suffer in a way that they don't deserve. They have the ability to rise above that, but they still might suffer in a way that they don't deserve. That's the first mahalach. The second mahalach is that that would never happen to someone in any of the first two classes. It will happen to the person who's in the third class, but in that case, that's because he rejected HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He departed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He said, I'm not interested. And so, yes. It's just for him to be left to Teva, but for someone who connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on some level, tries to, so they're always subject to partial hashgacha. What does partial hashgacha mean? Partial hashgacha means that they won't suffer unjustly due to Teva, though they won't always be subject to shmira from Teva. It's only the first category of people that are zocha to shmira from Teva constantly.
So what is the impact or the effect of that partial hashgacha? Like, what's left over when you say that they're not zocha to the shmira?
Not being zocha to shmira means that teva will never harm them. The middle category of people will be harmed by teva if they're deserving of harm.
So the hashgacha's effect is that they only suffer from teva if they are deserving. Some kind of punishment.
So anytime somebody gets, right, and we should point out, punishment is not always the right word to use, but yes, they're if it's not right for them, then that won't happen. Mm-hmm. But the first class of people, they will never be subject to teva at all. They'll have constant shmira from teva. You'll say, well, you know, how could they die? Well, their dying isn't a result of teva. You know, could be that that's the pshat in Chazal, that Hashem, you know, David HaMelech, for him to die, he had to be Mesiach Das for a second, like that whole story. And then Taka.
Yeah.
But that's the difference. That's the difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
My pleasure. Shkayach, good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.